You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, since the pandemic started, we've seen a lot less of our casual friends, the people we run into, you know, every now and then or see when we're out and about. We'll talk about what those friendships do for us and why we're missing them so much. Now, the last 3 weeks in January were the deadliest of the entire pandemic. Since then, cases have dropped by about 40%, but in most parts of the country, your chances of contracting the virus are still extremely high. It's all complicated by variants of the coronavirus that have been found around the country. They're all more contagious, it looks like, and preliminary studies have found that some of them might be deadlier or make the vaccines a little less effective. Our next guest is a Wisconsin expert on infectious disease, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about COVID-19 and the virus that causes it? Have you gotten vaccinated yet? What do you want to know about what is and wasn't safe to do right now? Do you worry about the new coronavirus variants? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Dr. Mary Beth Graham is a professor at the Medical College of Wisconsin and Medical Director of Infection Prevention and Control for Frederick Hospital. She's an internal medicine and infectious disease specialist. Dr. Graham, welcome back to Central Time.
Good afternoon.
Well, we saw January a very high death toll nationwide, but some good news, I think. It looks like our case numbers dropping around the country. What are you watching for those big picture numbers right now?
So if you do look at the numbers, they feel a lot different in the hospital right now. I will tell you that as compared to what they were in the late fall and during December. The goal that most people would like to see is we'd like to get back down to the 7-day positivity rate of somewhere of less than 5%. And to put that into perspective, when we were in November, late November, our percent positivity rate was around 38%. We had a peak after Thanksgiving where it was at 32%. We had another peak after Christmas. We were back up into the 30% range. But as of just this past week, we're down to 19.7%. So, I mean, this is great. The numbers have come down, but we still have a ways to go to get down to those goals of that definitely less than 10%, less than 5% would be the best.
Why do you think the numbers are going down? Was it just kind of a natural peak? Do you think we're being better now about our mask wearing and avoiding that indoor contact with people so much? What do you see driving at least that the trend in the right direction?
I think that this is all, a lot of it is incredibly multifactorial. I mean, you could look at the peak after Thanksgiving and the peak after Christmas and say, oh, well, this was due to people getting together, you know, lack of social distancing, travel, et cetera. But if you look at the run-up to that time from September up until early November, there was really a dramatic increase. And again, the question would be, was that, you know, there's probably multiple things with that. It's people going indoors more rather than being outdoors as much, where you could essentially see air handling is a little bit different. People back getting COVID fatigue, I think, potentially pays a part of it, you know, in terms of not wanting to remain isolated from other individuals. You can't look at one specific thing. Was it because of kids going back to school? No, you can't point to that because there a lot of kids stayed virtual and many schools that brought kids back did not see this. You look at college campuses, that was around that time. So potentially college campuses drove it early on. There are so many factors that go into the numbers that we see with regards to the spread and the number of cases. It's really very difficult to kind of break that down.
Talking to Dr. Mary Beth Graham from the Medical College of Wisconsin and Frederick Hospital, looking at the latest COVID-19 news and developments. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. Dr. Graham, now here come the vaccines. I've seen some reporting saying, you know, when we see a number like 90% effective or whatever the number might be, in some ways, that's underselling the vaccine. Those effectiveness rates, and please correct me if I have this wrong, that's how much you avoid getting the disease at all. It also seems to, for those who get the disease, reduce its severity, its hospitalizations, its potential lethality. Do I have that right, first of all?
That's exactly right. I mean, that's exactly right. The effectiveness, essentially, as we look at it, is the, if you'd say you, it's essentially 60%, if it's 60% effective, you've got a 60% greater chance of not getting disease if exposed to it than somebody who was not vaccinated. But there are other things with this. Even if you're not 100% effective, and there are very few things that are 100% effective, in terms of decreasing morbidity, mortality, those other symptoms. So in terms of a COVID infection, people who would get the COVID vaccine, in all likelihood, you may have people who are totally protected and not get it, younger individuals, but it doesn't 100% prevent that. People could still become infected but have absolutely no symptoms. And when we're looking at death tolls and the number of people, the way that COVID affects different groups, having that vaccine and decreasing that chance of the severe illness where somebody will end up in the hospital, end up in our ICUs, and potentially not making it is the real hope of having the vaccine. The vaccine isn't there to say COVID's going to go away. That's not what it's there for. It's there to truly decrease the impact of the disease on our communities.
Got a couple callers with questions related to vaccines. Ben starts us off in La Crosse. Ben, hi.
Hi. Try to follow my thinking here on this. There are approximately 25 million people in the United States who have had the virus and recovered from it. I have heard an expert say that having had the virus bestows somewhere in the neighborhood of 75 to 80% immunity for at least 3 months on the people who have recovered. Given that there is a bit of a crisis and time is of the essence in terms of getting vulnerable populations vaccinated, and given the fact that there are these variants that are coming up that the vaccines may not be as effective towards resisting, I'm just curious as to why there has not been the national impetus to place people who have had the disease and recovered from it lower on the priority list.
Okay, Ben, thanks for the call. A lot there. Dr. Graham, first of all, should Ben is saying maybe people who have had COVID-19 and recovered, they should be bumped down on the vaccine list. What's the thinking on that?
That actually is a really insightful question, and I appreciate that. As we go by CDC guidance, again, they've been very clear about setting up the tiers in terms of determining who gets it. Their recommendation was for people who had COVID to still get the vaccine if they fit in the specific tiers. So the issue is the healthcare professional, you know, in that tier one, even if they'd had it, there was potential benefit to get it again, because we're worried about, could we potentially bring it into the workplace? We don't want our patients becoming sick, nor do we want to deplete the workforce. So if we have many healthcare workers who are getting sick and leaving the workforce, then we're left without people to provide care. And the same as you go into the 1B, so the 1A and the 1B, I think that essentially by having those tiers of the 1A and the 1B, again, the people over 65, other people who are essential workers, other aspects of healthcare, that helps balance out that for people who had it before. The problem with having had COVID before is that it depends on how severe the infection was the first time. If somebody had a very, very mild infection the first time, there's a lot of literature out there that says typically antibodies will wane within about 3 months. If somebody had a more severe infection, those antibodies may last longer. So the other thing that's built into it is CDC does say on their website is if you have had COVID within the last 90 days, you could delay vaccination for 90 days until that 90-day period is up. So it's not that they are saying absolutely do it, but they do put it as a caveat. If you have had it, you can elect to delay vaccination for 90 days after your recovery from COVID.
Thanks for that call. We're talking about the latest COVID-19 developments with Dr. Mary Beth Graham. She's a professor at the Medical College of Wisconsin and medical director of infection prevention and control for Froedtert Hospital. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about any of these topics, the vaccines, the new variants, the changing numbers on COVID-19 over time? Do you have a personal experience having had COVID, having gotten vaccinated, or working in healthcare through all of this? 800-642-1234 is the number, or you can email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk now with infectious disease expert Dr. Mary Beth Graham, Medical Director of Infection Prevention and Control for Frederick Hospital. She's also with the Medical College of Wisconsin. She's helping us understand the latest COVID news, the vaccines, what we know about virus variants. We'll get to that in just a few moments. And you can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and your questions. Go back to your calls now. Pam is with us in Rhinelander. Pam, hi.
Hi. I'd like to know more about the COVID vaccination adverse event reporting system. I understand there's at least three databases, and that only one, the VAERS database, is being used.
Pam, thanks for the call. So what do we know about, Dr. Graham, about adverse reactions from the vaccines and how we keep track of those?
Well, one of the easiest ways to do it after you get it, there's a phone app that's called VSafe. So everybody who gets their vaccine is actually given a sheet so that they can go onto that website, document, put in their information, tell them when they got the vaccine. And then CDC shoots you a text message pretty much every single day for the first 7 days afterwards. And they do it at the 14th day after, and then they remind you when your next shot is. So I received my first vaccine on December the 31st, my second one on January 21st, and I used that system, and they asked questions in terms of side effects, et cetera, and they put on there that they could contact you. If somebody doesn't have access to that, yes, you can go to the VAERS website and put in information about side effects. So and the other way to do it, too, is to talk to your primary care physician, because it'd be good to put that in your medical record so that somebody knows for the future, you know, should they give you that vaccine again, et cetera. So, again, contacting your primary if you've had a significant reaction to the vaccine.
Thanks for that call. And big picture, I think over 100 million doses of vaccine given worldwide so far. Pretty rare adverse effects, it sounds like, or at least apart from maybe minor ones?
They're relatively minor. I mean, the more severe ones get reported in the news right away. But in general, it's mostly been local effects with pain around the arm, allergic reactions with swelling that can occur. Some people will get diarrhea, body aches, et cetera. But in general, the vast majority of people have some symptom afterward, but it's mild to moderate, which could last maybe 24 to 48 hours, and then those symptoms are gone.
Before we go back to our callers, I wanted to ask about the variants of this virus. Mutations occur with viruses, especially when there's zillions of them around the world now. Some we don't care about, but some seem to spread faster. And there are questions, you know, is one going to be more lethal to an individual who gets it? What do you have your eye on when it comes to these variants?
So the thing that's important to understand is that when any type of virus replicates or makes more of itself, there are changes in the genetic makeup of that virus, which essentially is a variant or a mutation. Some of those variations or mutations can make the virus what we would call less fit, and we would never know about those. So something can change with coronavirus that makes it such that that spike protein doesn't adhere as well to the cells in our body. We would never know about it. What we do find out about are the ones where there have been changes in the virus such that the virus essentially is more effective in terms of entering cells. Viruses can't do anything unless they enter some type of a cell, whether it's an animal cell or a human cell. They need to get into that cell to take over the machinery to make more of themselves. And so the most recent variants that they've talked about, the one that's mostly in the news, is the UK variant. It's the B1.1.7. What's interesting on that one is it appears that there is something that's happened in the genetic makeup of the virus so that the spike protein that it makes, and that's a protein that sits on the surface of the virus, that's what attaches when you breathe it in and it goes in. That's the part of the virus that attaches to specific receptors on the cells in your respiratory system. So there's something about the change that was made in the UK variant that makes that virus much more attractive to go and attach to those cells and then get into the cell. So what it changes is how infectious it is. You may read things about something called R0. So for every person who's infected, how many people will be in, for if I'm infected, how many people can I infect? So the R0, if we look at for coronavirus right now, is about for every person who's infected, you'll infect 2 to 2.5 people. For these variants, it seems like they infect more people. So it may be two and a half to three people. I'm sorry. Yeah.
That's okay. Take a moment. We're talking to Dr. Mary Beth Graham, Medical Director of Infection Prevention and Control for Froedtert Hospital, also at the Medical College of Wisconsin, looking at some of the latest COVID-19 news. So, Dr. Graham, you're saying these variants could have a higher R value, replication value.
That R0. Yeah, I feel like a cat. I think I swallowed a hairball. Anyway, so I apologize.
We've all been there.
The virus has become much more easily transmissible. So again, rather than 1 to 2 people, it could be 1 to 3 people. The other viruses, the South African and the Brazilian virus, Brazilian variant, again, very similar to that in terms of that R0 is going to be higher. The thing though that is really interesting though is that the question of if that changes and makes it more infectious, will it also change the immunity that we are getting either from a prior infection or the immunity that we get from a vaccine to protect against it? Those are the big questions right now. And it seems that potentially those variants, it will affect the immunity that somebody has to those if they've had COVID before, so that they'd be more susceptible to get those, or if they had the vaccine. But it doesn't seem, at least at this point in time, to totally knock it out. So rather than that 90% efficacy, it may take something back down to possibly like a 50 to 60% efficacy, which is still quite good, you know, in terms of decreasing our ability to become ill with the virus. So it's not like, well, it's not going to work anymore.
Let's go back to our callers. Kristen is with us in Appleton. Kristen, hi.
Hi there. I'm calling to ask about vaccination recommendations in terms of pregnancy. There seems to be some different recommendations coming from different countries, and I'm just curious about that.
Good question, Kristen. Thanks. What do we know, Dr. Graham? Vaccinations for people who are pregnant.
So, again, that's a great question. As we look at it, there are, in the trials that were done with the vaccines, pregnant women were not included in the trials. Neither were children. So this is why they can't make a recommendation for children under the age of 16 or 18, because it's different between Pfizer and Moderna, or make a definitive recommendation. However, the mRNA vaccines that we have right now, they are really a safe vehicle. And the usually what is coming out and what the CDC says is that the provider should talk with the patient to see, you know, talk to them about the fact that it hasn't been studied. It does appear to be safe. We definitely don't usually recommend new vaccines, et cetera, in that first trimester, because that's always the tender time. But again, weighing those risks and benefits in terms of that risk of getting COVID during the course of pregnancy versus getting the vaccine. And so there's not an absolute recommendation to not get it, but it's also not, it's one of those, talk to the provider, find out exactly, you know, what you think, how you feel about it. Same with breastfeeding. Do you want to go forward with this? And I know that sounds wishy-washy, and I apologize for that. But again, in the absence of data or studies, you have to temper your recommendation that way.
Thanks a lot for that call. Time for one more caller. JT is with us in Madison. JT, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. one quick or a couple quick questions here. If I decide to get the vaccine, I was wondering how long will the vaccine last, and will one vaccine last longer than the other? Will Moderna last longer than the Pfizer vaccine? And my second question would be, after being vaccinated, will there be enough vaccination for another round of vaccination, depending on where they're at with their numbers?
Got it, JT. Thanks for the call. So briefly, relative protection or time of protection from the different vaccines, and will second doses be available just in our last minute, Dr. Graham?
So Moderna and Pfizer equivalent to each other. They're both mRNA vaccines. Get whichever one that you have in your community. So one's not better than the other. With regards to availability, right now, it appears that the states are trying to make sure that the people who get the vaccine, that there will be vaccine available for the second shot for most people so that they can get it on the time that was recommended. That may change. I know that the CDC has talked about whether we can get more people vaccinated with the first shot and delay that second shot. However, that was not the way it was studied, so we're not sure yet. But again, that is something that is being looked at. The last one is, what if they make a new vaccine to cover one of the variants? Would you need a booster? Moderna is already working on a booster for some of the variants. I think Pfizer probably will be too. So that's going to be another question that comes up in terms of, do you get the initial series and then the booster, or will the vaccine actually change down the line? The newer vaccines that will be out probably in the next 2 months may be one and done. So those are different vaccines. They aren't mRNA vaccines. They're what are referred to as adenoviral vector vaccines. And one of them is a one-shot deal. The other one is a two-shot. So there will be a lot of options for vaccination to get that coverage for people across the country.
Dr. Graham, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us again today.
Thank you. I apologize for my little coughing fit.
That's okay. It even happens to the professionals. That was Dr. Mary Beth Graham, professor at the Medical College of Wisconsin and medical director of infection prevention and control for Froedtert Hospital. She joined us for a look at the latest COVID-19 developments. Since the COVID-19 pandemic started nearly a year ago, many of us haven't been able to see our family and friends as much as we'd like, and a lot of people have found creative ways to keep those close relationships strong. But what about the friends you aren't quite so close to? The coworker you chat with in the break room, your favorite bartender, an old classmate you run into from time to time? If you are missing those casual friendships, you're not alone. Our next guest feels the same and found there's plenty of reasons why our outer circle of friends is so important. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you feel yourself missing those everyday encounters with more casual friends? What do those types of relationships do for you? Why do you think they matter? Are you looking forward to bringing them back? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Amanda Mull is a staff writer at The Atlantic. Her latest piece is called "The Pandemic Has Erased Entire Categories of Friendship." Amanda, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
What got you thinking about this sort of outer circle, the blurry line between their friend and acquaintance, somewhere in between?
Well, this is something that had been sort of nagging at me since the very beginning of the pandemic, because I am a very chatty person. I like to be a regular at bars and restaurants near my apartment. I like chatting with my building's UPS guy. I like to talk. But a couple of months ago, I was watching the first episode of the Netflix show, Emily in Paris. And in one of the very first scenes, you see the main character and her boyfriend in a bar watching sports. And I just flashed back to spending, fall Saturdays watching college football in a bar in Manhattan with a bunch of other fellow displaced University of Georgia alumni. And I felt such longing to be able to do that again, to be around hundreds of other people who are just all excited about the same thing, all paying attention to the same thing, all excited to be together. I just really missed that energy so much.
Well, and I'm not the chattiest of people in real life, but I got to say, when I'm out for a walk in the neighborhood and I walk and I run into that, person I've known for a while, they're not a friend. It's awesome now. It's like this great thing, and I realize how much I miss it. And I'm guessing you and I aren't alone here. This turns out, and you talked to some researchers on this, This is an important part of our lives.
Right, right. You're getting it an important dynamic here because this is something that most introverts experience as well. The peripheral contacts in our lives, what sociologists call weak ties, are extremely important to people because they provide variety, they provide low-stakes social interaction, they provide all kinds of serendipity and joy and wonder that you get in like little doses throughout the day on a normal day. And that is really important. And it's really important for people who find larger, more important social interactions draining too, because these interactions are just low stakes. They don't have a lot of pressure that goes along with them. And they can be really sustaining and helpful to people psychologically.
Yeah, why is that? I mean, if we ask people what relationships are important to you, they, you know, close family member, best friend, spouse, kids, that kind of thing. Why is it that these more distant relationships can do so much for us?
American culture doesn't have a lot of words to refer to all of these different types of friends that we have. I asked every researcher I spoke to, like, what do we call these people? And really, it's just friend. But American culture also says that we should get most of what we need or all of what we need from our closest ties, from our friends, from our best friends, from our closest family, from our romantic partners. And really, that's just not how human minds work. We need variety. We need people to bring us new information, to snap us out of our ruts, things like that. And I think until these relationships were gone, a lot of people didn't even realize that they had really existed in the first place because we completely gloss over them as a culture.
And it's easy to gloss over, more easier to gloss over those during the pandemic, it seems like, because with those close ties, we're going to go to the effort to make the phone call or set up the video chat or something. I'm not going to go, hey, guy I run into at band shows twice a year, let's do a Zoom chat. And that they're not going to do it with me either. So it's been really hard to maintain those things now.
Right. So much of socialization during the pandemic is really effortful and purposeful and scheduled and carefully planned because you want to be safe. You don't want to infect anybody. You want to be in an environment where everybody can feel comfortable. But that requires a lot of forethought. It also requires you to reach out to people directly. It requires you to have their phone numbers, to know their full name. And a lot of these weaker ties, the people throughout our lives that we interact with every day, you just don't have their contact information, first of all, let alone the real desire to go on a Zoom happy hour with them. For a lot of the people in our lives, that's just not an appropriate way to hang out. You need to encounter them in life, in the places where your relationships have flowered in the past. And a lot of those places are just cut off right now.
We're talking to Amanda Mull from The Atlantic. She wrote a piece on, you know, not our closest circle of friends and family, that next group out, how we've lost those contacts, those relationships in many ways during the pandemic, and why they're so important to us. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this something you feel like you're missing? Have you found a way to replace it and have those chance encounters with the coworkers or people at the store or wherever you run into people? 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We heard from another Amanda actually on Twitter. This is you. I think a quote from you, Amanda. I cannot wait for some random person I never want to have dinner with to slosh some beer on me in a bar, apologize, joke around with me about her 50 seconds after I decline an offer to get my next drink, and then we both move on with our evenings. That sounds awesome. In a way that it didn't a year ago. Are we going to come out of this, do you think, more interested in making sure we have these kind of contacts in our lives?
Yes, I think that there will be sort of a transition period where everybody sort of relearns what it feels like to be outside and among people again. I think it'll be really, really exciting, but we're so not used to that level of stimulation right now that I think that it'll be a process of getting back. But once it's safe, once people really feel like they can embrace all the things that they were missing, I think that it's going to be sort of a glorious period of realizing that you're just happy to see people you don't even like. You're happy to see people who might have annoyed you before. You're happy to see the guy, like I said, the guy who, you know, bumps you at the bar and spills his beer on you a little bit. I think that all of those interactions, you know, are opportunities to see our humanity reflected back at us. And that's just really important.
We had a call from a listener in Madison who can stay on the line, who has a name for these people. Their name for that is significant strangers. I don't know. What do you think of that term, Amanda?
I think that that is a great term for a subset of these people, because I think that you sort of immediately know who that is in your life when you hear it. The UPS guy who comes to my building, who I love seeing, I don't know his name. I don't think he knows my first name because it's on the packages.
Right.
But he's a significant stranger to me. I love seeing him. When I saw him the first time after after things eased up in New York a little bit, where I am right now, I almost cried. I was so happy to see him.
We are talking about, well, significant strangers, casual friends, acquaintances, workplace relationships, maybe not the closest person. Amanda Mull is with us from The Atlantic. She wrote about this, and we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Is this something you have been missing, whether you've been thinking about it or noticing it or not, or you're just thinking about it now that we're talking about it? Do you look forward to being able to just run into people at the bar or the restaurant or the coffee shop or the workplace if you're working from home? What do you miss about those relationships? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Amanda Mull from The Atlantic about the casual friendships and everyday encounters we're having a lot less of during the pandemic and why they have value in our lives, why we miss them, and maybe if we look forward to them. How about you? 800-642-1234. Is there a particular interaction you've been missing since the pandemic started at the workplace, at the store, you name it? Tell us about it. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Amanda, I mentioned the workplace a couple times. You wrote some about that without those casual encounters, maybe between boss and employee, for example. It might actually hurt things, hurt the workplace dynamic. What do we see there?
Yes, there's a couple of potential problems lurking in the workplace because of the loss of all of these weak ties. I spoke to one researcher in particular who had done some research on how people behave in instructor-instructee conversations, which of course happens a lot at the workplace between bosses and employees. And what he found is that when those types of pairs have more unstructured time to talk with each other, it sort of helps balance the conversation, because normally when someone is telling someone else what to do, the instructor is the person who talks a lot. If you have that unstructured time, the employee in this case gets to put their two cents in, gets to feel heard, gets to feel like their interaction is mutual and like everybody understands what's going on. What he found is that when that happens, both parties report much higher satisfaction and much more happiness with those interactions. But that can really only happen in person. You run into people, you linger over the communal coffee pot, you run out to grab lunch together, things like that. With all of the tools that we have for digital work, you end up with really, really structured time. In Zoom calls, for example, there is almost always a really clear idea of who is going to be talking and who is going to be listening, how long they're going to last, and what is going to be covered. So you really lose all those opportunities for employees to feel heard and appreciated and like they're contributing and like their concerns are being heard.
You pointed out in your piece, Amanda, even before the pandemic, there were concerns about at least a decent chunk of the American population already feeling kind of isolated. What are we seeing as we lose these contacts that might have helped us at least a little bit break out of that trend?
Right. A big problem is that America has been on sort of a path to loneliness and personal isolation for quite a long time. We have lost a lot of social institutions, a lot of cultural institutions, community institutions. People are less religious. They're more clustered in suburbs. And it's just harder to get to know the people around you, which leads to loneliness. And what research indicates on that is that you end up feeling this isolation in your body. I spoke to one researcher who had found that for people who are socially isolated, their chance of premature death by any type of mortality rose 30%, which is significant. People start to sort of decompensate when they're alone. They don't keep up their hygiene habits. They don't keep up their personal health habits. They may forget to take their medication because the days sort of run into each other and it's harder to mark time. They may not eat regularly, or they may eat sort of irregularly. They may eat too much, or they may not get good produce and things like that because they feel like they can't go out. So you have a lot of situations in which things can really go wrong if you don't have that constant check-in of just these random little social interactions and feeling like you're part of a community. It can also be really bad for people's sense of psychological isolation. And what one researcher told me is that when people don't feel connected to their communities in real life, they go searching for community online. Sometimes that can be great. You find groups of people on the internet that love baseball or knitting or something like that, that you also love. On the other hand, a lot of the platforms and companies that we use are sort of incentivized to put you on a track toward perhaps niche political groups. And that, I think, is responsible for some of the acceleration in extremism that we've seen over the past year, especially to some more fringe groups, cult-like groups, things like that, because people are looking for certainty and they're looking for support, and these groups swoop in when they see people like that.
We're talking to Amanda Mull, staff writer at The Atlantic, about a piece she wrote on a decline in casual friendships. It's harder to have those chance encounters with people during the pandemic at the bar, restaurant, store, diner, workplace, you name it. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you find yourself missing that, that's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. All right, Amanda, you put a lot of thought into this. You talked to some experts about it. Have you found a way, again, given that we can't go out and really gather in places still, have you found any way to get at least a taste of some of that casual friendship interaction?
You know, I haven't found any great methods that I can repeat every day like I would going to a coffee shop or something like that, because, you know, there are still protocols in place to keep people away from each other and to keep people from lingering. But a couple of weeks ago, I heard about a great new breakfast burrito in my neighborhood, and I decided to walk over one Sunday morning. I apparently decided to do that at the exact same time that all of the rest of the neighborhood was hearing about this and deciding to make the same choice. So I got there, and there was, you know, like I said, I live in New York, and this is a very New York experience. Just a line of people down the block waiting patiently, mostly, to try this breakfast burrito. And I just got in line and sort of listened to the chatter of people around me and looked at everybody's outfits, and just had a great time just being in like a line of humanity down the block, like we all used to before this all happened. So, you know, I think that there are experiences out there available to you if you're willing to get in the wrong burrito line.
Now, one thing I've tried, and you're a sports fan, so I don't know, maybe you've done something like this. I've watched Packers games, of course, is what we're going to watch here, and just had a text circle with some old buddies who, you know, we never see each other really anymore. They're scattered around the country, and we just have a, you know, Packers game length text chain going along. Have you done anything like that with your, I don't know, fellow University of Georgia fans?
Yes, I've done some things like that. Back at the beginning of college football season, we had a virtual tailgate where a bunch of our New York City-based dog fans could get on and sort of see each other's faces and, you know, in a very low-stakes, low-pressure environment while One of the first games of the season was on TV, and that was great. And I've also, you know, been texting with people, some people I haven't seen in years, that you know, this opportunity to talk a whole lot has just sort of rekindled our friendship in that way, because we were sort of separated by distance before, but now everybody's separated by distance, so why not? So there's been some sort of like surprising little things there. And I'm lucky because New York has done a really good job with outdoor dining and things like that. So I've gotten to go, you know, with a couple of close friends to a very small group of people to watch some football games outdoors in the past few months, which has been wonderful, although it's too cold now to do any of that. And football's almost over.
Right. We heard from Belle on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Belle writes, my family moved to a new area last year and I have young children. One of the hardest parts of the pandemic is that my boys don't have the opportunity to be outside in the yard meeting the other kids in the neighborhood. They really miss being able to go and have those interactions. As a parent, it's hard to explain and watch them go through the emotions they face being isolated. Yeah, those playground encounters for kids are off the table too, Amanda.
Right. This is a whole different challenge for parents. I was talking to one of my coworkers today who has a 2.5-year-old, and she was saying that she doesn't think her son remembers what it's like to be in anybody else's house because he hasn't been in a year, and he was only 1.5 years old then. So there's a lot of things that have been closed off to kids in really cruel ways that are you know, they're cruel, but they're not negotiable at this moment. And there's just, I don't think that there's any good or correct way to navigate these things. And I, you know, my heart goes out to parents. I don't have any good way to navigate that. I don't think anybody has. This is something that we've been trying to write a lot about at work, but it's just hard.
Great. Now we've got all the callers coming in. Now Margie is with us in Milwaukee. Margie, hi.
Hi there. Quick note, my mother is 95 and living in assisted living in Indiana, and I'm in Milwaukee. I used to drive down every 6 weeks and stay with her for about a week in her apartment with her. I obviously haven't done that for a year. And in the first 6 months, she lost 20 pounds. Mm-hmm. And, you know, everybody in the assisted living is masked. They didn't go out of their rooms for meals. Everything was so isolated. I purchased a GrandPad, which is like an individual computer, but it's not like with the internet. It's through a phone company. And mom has this little 9-inch screen at her table. And I can call her on my phone, and then I can take my phone around through the neighborhood and show her like people's flowers or Christmas decorations. And once in a while, if there's a person on the street, I'll say, hey, will you want to talk to my mom? And I'll shift it up there and mom will talk. And it's been a good connection. She can see me, I can see her, but she's 95. She can't use a computer.
Sure. Margie, I'm going to jump in because we're just about out of time. The part of that I thought was neat for our conversation, Amanda, was, you know, her mom gets to run into a person on the street.
Yeah, I think that there are really creative ways that this can be used. And I think it's especially important for our elderly who are so separated from everybody else, even more so than the rest of America is in this situation, and finding any creative ways that we can to make them feel connected and make them feel loved and make them feel like part of the world again is great.
Thanks for that call. And Amanda, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us again today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Amanda Mull is a staff writer at The Atlantic. She talked with us about her latest piece called The Pandemic Has Erased Entire Categories of Friendship. You can find a link to that at wpr.org/centraltime. You can also share your thoughts and stories on the Ideas Network Facebook page.